You're listening to All The Best. I'm Michael Bryden. And today we've got two stories for you on rejection, renouncement, and turning your back. If you turn your back on something, you basically refuse to acknowledge its existence. And that can be hard to do, particularly in the case of this first story, where what you're turning your back on is your country. Last year, All The Best contributor Selena Shannon sat down with a man who formally renounced his Australian citizenship.
A couple of months ago, an article in The Guardian Australia caught my attention. The piece was a unique story by Paul Daly called The Man Who Renounced Australia. It was hidden beneath all the stories of the day in that odd forgotten space where The Guardian places its editor's picks, right at the bottom of the page. This was in August, so it appeared during those early days of the ISIS advances, when the words renouncing Australia were reserved for people who'd left our country to fight alongside the Islamic State. They were associated with people who some regarded to be traitors, or another misguided oversimplification. At this time, the unfounded idea that your sole citizenship could be taken away from you was being talked about a lot by politicians and journalists. Instead, I was surprised to find that the man who renounced Australia had a far more interesting story to tell. This man, once known as the journalist Jeremy Geyer, was Murumu Wallabara Yidinji, one of the first people to voluntarily give up his Australian citizenship and fight for what could be one of the first sovereign tribal states on our continent.
Murumu Wallabara Yidinji, Gomani Buri Bulwar Mulawai Yitinajin, Nayondo Nya British Bama, Nya Saxon Bama, Nya English, Nya Indigenous Bama, Nya Australian Bama, the Crown Sovereignty, Najin Nyara. Basically, what I just said was that my name is Murumu Wallabara Yidinji, and the first fire that was ever lit on our lands belongs to Yidinji, which is our way of saying, Qui prior est tempore est potior est jure. First in time is best in law. We are not British, we're not Saxon, we're not English, we're not Indigenous, we're not Australian. We are only Yidinji. And for those people who want to know where Yiti is, or Yidinji lands are, it's commonly known to the Crown as Cairns, just below Port Douglas, just above Innisfail, includes Atherton and parts of Mareeba and the Tablelands. But what we're saying is, we're here, and Yidinji is open for business.
Murumu's story excited me. He'd thrown away his passport, his license, and every other document that bound him to the Crown. He was free, and he wanted his tribe to come with him. It seemed like the kind of story that would spark a wave of intrigue and debate. I waited for Murumu's ideas to multiply across the internet, at least the Australian internet, and be weighed in on by everyone. Which is why it was puzzling when the story's lifespan lasted barely more than a few days. It seemed like that first article had only scratched the surface of this fascinating guy. A friend and I decided to track Murumu down and dig deeper into his reasons for renouncing Australian citizenship, what the significance of the decision was for his tribe, and what political moves would be in store next. But before we go into that, let me introduce Murumu a little bit more.
The reason why I renounced Australia was because the Crown experiment was truly over when I saw the behaviour of parliamentarians and their lack of respect for the Australian people. For those who don't know, I was the political editor for the National Indigenous TV News, based out of the Federal Parliament in Canberra, one of the first Western journalists, well, the first Western journalist to interview Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And many other things I've done in my life that have really helped paint a picture of who I am and who I am not and what I'm not.
It took a little while to organise an interview with the man himself. Along with his citizenship, Murimu has renounced a lot of the modern forms of communication that would traditionally be keeping him on the grid. We eventually located his Twitter account, which he would occasionally log into using his friend's internet, and a few weeks later, when he was passing through Sydney, we set up an interview at his friend's house in Leichhardt. Murimu was a really warm, friendly man, and he set us up outside on the veranda with a pot of tea. We chatted there beneath screeching cockatoos and low-flying planes while his friend's kids chased each other around the house.
You really must know who you are. And once you know who you are, you can't be part of a fraud. And the name on the license, the passport and everything else did not belong to me. It belonged to the Crown and or the Commonwealth of Australia. So at that particular point, I said, enough's enough. You can have all your paperwork back. I'm going back to the Yidinji Tribal Society, which is where I was born.
In the original Guardian article about Murimu, the journalist writing the piece chose to focus on citizenship and how Murimu could live, practically, without a passport, driver's license or Medicare card. But when we spoke about it, he seemed pretty disinterested in discussing it. Mostly he was excited to explore the political future for his tribe, Yidinji. Renouncing citizenship was not a difficult decision, he told me. The documents that bound him to the Crown were the only place where his citizenship existed, and that legally binding status held no importance to him or his sense of personal identity. Freeing himself of those papers was a small step in his tribe's mission for independence from the monarchy and the federal government. It's been a long journey so far. In fact, Yidinji has been campaigning for their independence for quite some time.
We're saying that in 2012 we put out a notice to the world, and that included Elizabeth Alexandra Mary, who is also known as the Queen, to the Pope, and to many other people, including the Prime Minister at the time, and saying that we're going to do this, take back our control of our ancestral lands and our tribal lands and territories, seas and skies, and that if you object to any of these things through your standing of law, then do so in writing. Now, that did not take place. We gave 28 days for people to respond, and the Crown didn't respond, and neither did the Commonwealth of Australia. So now, an unrebutted claim of affidavit of truth becomes the truth in law. So, because they acquiesced and they defaulted by their consent, now Yidinji and the Tribal Society is now the true authority on this land. What we've done in January the 7th, 2013, is we also send out more notifications that we would be setting up the governance structure of the Tribal Society, and we'd be setting up our own courts and conducting and fishing activities, mining, forestry, and a whole raft of activities. Once again, that remained uncontested, and no one had objected to it.
This was a lot to digest. Is this all it would take for Yidinji to be its own nation? Could silence from those in power really give the tribe autonomy? Well, no. According to Murimu, his tribe requires another country's formal recognition as well, in order to be legitimised as an emerging state. And as it turns out, the Russian Federation of all countries has stepped up.
Magistrates, police officers and any other agents of the Crown have to be very careful now that if they interfere with our business, we now have the diplomatic channel and reporting mechanism with the Russian Federation, where any violations or crimes against the tribal society will be reported at an international level now, including but not limited to the United Nations. So now we are distinctly different from Australians. Yidinji is now witness to the crimes that have happened on our lands. Because we're not Australians, remember. But now we can see, hey, we think those Australians over there stole our property, committed crimes against the tribes, they killed a few people, they took a few children away from their families. And that's what we're mounting up now. So this may enter the International Criminal Court arena or the ICJ, and some other country may want to sponsor that.
Murimu's story was part poetic ideology and part gritty legal details. For example, he explained to me that if Yidinji ever became its own state, and say there was an airport on Yidinji soil, then airlines wouldn't need Australia's permission to land there. They could bypass the Commonwealth's authority. Of course, Yidinji is not really interested in that sort of stuff, and once they have full autonomy, they'll probably disengage from most of that political horseplay. But being a separate country does give them the authority to mount a case in the International Court of Justice against Australia for the crimes committed on their land against their people. And that's a really big deal. If other tribes followed in Yidinji's footsteps, it would have huge repercussions across the continent, potentially the world. I asked Marumu if he thought he could start a nationwide movement to emancipate other Indigenous tribes across Australia. As soon as I asked the question, though, I regretted it. I was doing the very thing Marumu was criticising, lumping together a group of people we commonly refer to as Aboriginal, with total disregard for their varied backgrounds and differences. Worse, I was implying one person could speak for all of them, and that's something Marumu does not want to do. All he wants is a dialogue with Australia's leaders, and according to him, that's just not happening.
So some people want to be Indigenous Australian or First Australian, and like we're saying, that's up to you guys. But in our area, we don't want that. But if other groups around Australia, or the continent known to the Crown as Australia, want to identify with Australia and be included in the Constitution, and that's their business, and we have no right to tell them differently. And we have no right to force them into our way of thinking. The same goes with the Crown or the Commonwealth of Australia. They have no right to forcefully try and assimilate us into their constitution.
It's still unclear to me why this story never really went anywhere in the media. It's so fascinating and unique. Many people I've spoken to put it down to the sad reality that it's a real struggle for Indigenous stories to be given the exposure they deserve. Makes you wonder whether there are other tribes in Australia doing similar things. And if there aren't, should there be? Marumu said there's possibly trillions of dollars that have been stripped from his tribal lands without permission from Yidinji. Now it's time for that to be acknowledged and paid back. By fighting for independence, Yidinji is really testing the legal waters of the Federation. Although Marumu doesn't want to start a revolution, his journey is one of empowerment that could lead the way for autonomous tribal societies across the continent. It could change Australia forever.
That story was produced by All the Best contributor Selena Shannon. Since she met Marumu last year, a few other groups have started to follow in Yidinji's footsteps, and some of the members have renounced their Australian citizenships as well. Marumu's tribe is currently working towards developing their own Yidinji number plates, driver's licenses, and passports. Marumu continues to live solely as a Yidinji citizen and continues to claim that he is no longer subject to the laws of Australia. Last week, Marumu was arrested in Canberra for failing to abide by an eviction notice. He was released on unconditional bail and will face court in February. I'm Michael Bryden, and you're listening to All the Best, where we're talking about turning your back, whether it's turning your back on a place, like Marumu did, or on people, like in this next story. See, the thing about turning your back on someone is that, to begin with, you have to embrace them. You have to let them in and trust them, and then they have to hurt you. This next story is about a man and his adopted community and how they turned their backs on each other.
My name's Richard Lawrence Broom, but we just call it Richard Broom, and I was professor at La Trobe University in the History Department. It's just a totally fascinating story. There's not too many times in our sort of history of the world that people have survived in this way, moved into another culture as a lone individual and survived that transition. Well, William Buckley was born in 1780 in Cheshire, and he came from a small rural labouring family and probably minimal education and opportunities when he was growing up. Buckley went into the army. Then when he came back, he got into some trouble and pilfered some cloth and other things. He got into trouble with the courts and eventually was sentenced to transportation. 1803, he landed with a group of people to form the first European settlement in Victoria out of nothing.
Or what the British settlers thought was nothing was the land of the Kulin Nation. It's now called Sullivan Bay, right near modern-day Sorrento, out to the east of Melbourne. And it was tough. There was no fresh water. The guards were drunk and abusive. And eventually, Buckley and a few other convicts decided to escape.
Of course, it was a very difficult thing to get away from a convict settlement. They had no skills of living off the land. There was no one to help them. They really didn't have an idea where they were geographically. Buckley, of course, tells the story later in his memoirs about the others dying or leaving him, and he is almost at death's door himself when he's found by an Aboriginal woman who believes she recognises a deceased relative.
The relative she recognised was Murrungurk, one of the elders of the Wasserung people.
It was an association of death and whiteness and whatever. So he is actually brought into the group and he's nursed back to health, and eventually, he's got no other options. So he stays with them until 1835. So he's with them for about 32 years, which is one of the most remarkable survival stories.
The story of William Buckley sounds like a story to celebrate reconciliation. On the face of it, it's a story where an early settler got it right, lived and worked with Indigenous Australians in a community as equals. That's what the history books say too, and that's what I thought. In fact, that's where the idea for this story came about. I got in touch with the Wasserung, the descendants of the men and women who lived with William Buckley for all those years. I wanted to ask them how they felt about Buckley as an honorary member of the Wasserung community. The answer they gave me was one I hadn't seen in any history books.
He was treated as a member. He was adopted as a member. He was part of Wadarong family at the time.
Is he still seen as a member?
Not in my eyes. No. we still hold our native law and... Yeah, he's definitely not.
Yeah. My name is Brian Powell. I'm the chairperson of the Wadarung Aboriginal Corporation, Wadarung Elder.
My name's Sean Fagan. I'm a Cultural Heritage Projects Officer for the Wadarung Aboriginal Corporation descendant traditional owner.
There's this skewed perception by everyone that Buckley survived. It was through his skills that he survived, which isn't quite true. He was kept alive. He was looked after. He was tended. He was treated like a god. And it was only through that, the goodwill of our ancestors, that he was able to live and be looked after. Other than that, if he hadn't picked up the spears and boomerangs off the gravesite, he would have been killed.
He wouldn't have been able to survive if he wasn't taught the skills of our people.
To spend 32 years and become part of a family and then turn your back on them, and ever since then, being portrayed as the only thing people really want to know about or learn about as far as Wadarung people are concerned. They don't want to know about the natives. All they want to know about is, how did Buckley survive? Was he a nice guy?
Well,
I mean, he wasn't a nice guy when it came to turning your back on your family. Whatever reasons he did it for, I mean, we can look back and we can see the situation he was in, but you don't turn your back on your family.
Whether Buckley did actually turn his back on his family is a heated debate within the modern Wasserung community. Buckley left the community after coming across an exploring party led by John Batman. Batman was a land grabber, a treaty negotiator, and a bounty hunter of Aboriginal people who helped start the settlement that later became the colony of Victoria. When Buckley left the group, he took with him 32 years of knowledge about the Wasserung and surrounding nations, and was given a job by the colony, interpreter to the natives. There's a question that's mostly absent from the history books, but still in the minds of the Wasserung. Did Buckley pass on knowledge about Wasserung land and traditions to help men like John Batman take their land and massacre their people? Or, as an interpreter, did he help Indigenous people during the period of settlement?
This period of settlement had such a devastating effect on us that for a time we were lost. Nobody knew we existed. We'd even lost the connection between our ancestors and our modern-day contemporaries. It was estimated, and through our research, there was around 3,000 to 4,000 Wadawurrung people. That's just Wadawurrung. That's no other mobs. That was around early 1800s. By late 1800s, we were down to two. Two people, a man and a woman. And it virtually came down to a child from that couple. So we descended from the last one.
He knew about colonisation, he knew about the empire, and if some white fellas start coming, there will be more. So he probably thinks this is an inevitable unfolding of an invasion and takeover. So he might have thought, well, I'll go back because of that.
Buckley was used. He was used by Batman as a means to achieving what Batman wanted. He needed to achieve sort of peaceful takeover of the country, and he saw Buckley as a tool to use during that for that outcome. It was like anything back in those days. Your value was based on what you could achieve, and what you could achieve for the settlement.
But also, Buckley is a man in the middle, because most of the Europeans think he's unintelligent, that he's a savage because he's lived with so-called savages. And like one guy says, well, why didn't he convert them all? You know, so that they think Buckley is a bit of a loser. So he doesn't get on with them. He's now got his Aboriginal friends' noses out of joint because he's up and left them. So that's why he becomes in a very difficult situation, and eventually he decides to go to Tasmania in 1837. So within two years or less, he's gone, because he says to La Trobe, I can't live here.
It hurts our people today to try and straddle two cultures in a modern society. So it would have been hell for Buckley, because his was more immediate. His was much more defined. His was a matter of life and death. Today, we have choices. It's not going to kill us if we make a wrong choice. In Buckley's time, it did. It would have played on his mind a hell of a lot more. It would have stuffed his head up. I mean, it would certainly stuff my mind up, knowing that I could be responsible for the death of so many people, or the lives of so many people. That's the decisions he had to make on a day-to-day basis.
You know, we can look at it in hindsight now, and what he did do was wrong.
No, I don't. I think if Buckley didn't exist, there still would have been removal of land, and there still would have been removal of children. So he has really no impact on that. He's just one little grain of sand on a white beach in terms of that.
He's not a grain of sand. He is the view that non-Aboriginal people like to see of their history. So the brave settlers, the brave new fleet, came to this country and they discovered it and they settled it. Well, I've got news for them. We were here for 60,000 years before white fellas came here. So there was no discovery of Australia. That's just the white fellas were late getting here. When it comes to the view of history, it's a sanitised view. Australians do not like to be reminded that this country was stolen, this country was invaded, that people were massacred, people, Aboriginal people en masse died for the sake of non-Indigenous people today. I don't think it's a case of blaming Buckley. It's more a case of the effects of what happened to Buckley. The ramifications went right across Wadawurrung people. it's still felt today. Like, I mean, everyone talks about Buckley, not about Wadawurrung. Buckley is a good point, a good starting point. If we can change the perception of Buckley, if we can change that story around, everyone that comes after will understand a little bit more about us. It'll be a huge step in reconciliation. Yeah, this is the start of a long journey.
That story was first broadcast on All the Best in 2013 and was produced by me, with supervising producer Belinda Lopez. This episode of All the Best was produced at Triple R in Melbourne in association with FBI Radio in Sydney, SIN in Melbourne, and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to Selena Shannon for her work on this episode. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jez O'Callaghan. My co-host is Pip Rasmussen, and I'm Michael Bryden. Head to our website, allthebestradio.com, to listen to more stories and subscribe to our podcast. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Take my ring off.